For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Speaking Freely. I'm Annette Newell. They got addicted to alcohol and drugs early in life. Then, they not only overcame their addiction, they turned it into a way to help others heal. And we're focusing on their stories in this episode. First, Joe Buck, the current mayor of Lake Oswego, tells us about his battle with alcohol at a young age. And he wants young people in Oregon to be more aware of this danger. He's also the owner of several restaurants that do serve alcohol, but he says the restaurant and bar industry is making changes, like including and promoting more non-alcoholic drink options. Mayor Buck is now ready to share what he once saw as a shameful secret.
I'm come with lots of lived experiences, the mayor of Lake Oswego, but more importantly here, someone who's living in recovery, long-term recovery from alcoholism. It wasn't until somewhat recently that I even started speaking publicly about living in recovery and what that has meant to me, and speaking out on various public policies and whatnot, starting to advocate for change within our communities. I really never knew that alcoholism was a disease until I was in recovery from it. All of my life, I've been conditioned to view it as a personal failing, something that was very shameful and that should be kept a secret. And that was part of the problem. Once I became sober, I learned that there was a large sober community that has existed all this time, but just so far in the shadows that I had no idea that it was there. I grew up in the restaurant business around bars and drinking and just immersed in that culture. For me personally, with my family, even though alcoholism is a part of our history, it was just something that we never talked about. Dark kind of family secret type things. It just was something that wasn't addressed. As a kid, an adolescent, as a teen growing up, even the concept of someone who didn't drink it was something that would have been foreign to me. I couldn't name one sober adult and wouldn't have even thought about it, but I knew that they were all around me. And it wasn't until I was in recovery that I started to meet them. But there were just people really close to me who were around me my entire life who lived in recovery, and never talked about it until we had that connection together as sober people. I grew up here in the Lake Oswego community, had a very loving family, a great education, and never, ever dreamed that I would get mixed up in drinking or go down a path of alcoholism. But that's exactly what happened shortly after I left for college and then joined the military. I was just immersed in a drinking culture. It was really all around me. And the moment I realized that things were off was when I returned home. I was on leave from the Coast Guard, and I returned home, and my parents were having a birthday celebration or something for one of them. And they said, "Oh, Joe, what would you?" And I had turned 21 over this period of time. And they said, "What do you like to drink?" And I said, "Oh, I like to drink vodka." And they said, "Oh, we'll get a bottle of vodka." They were more like wine drinkers. And so they got this fifth of vodka and they put it in the cabinet, and we had the party. And I went about drinking like I would normally do in the Coast Guard, and all was fine. And the next day I go downstairs and my mom's got the fifth of vodka, which was basically empty at that point. And she's like, "What happened here? Ed, did you consume all this?" And I said, "Oh, yeah. What's the problem?" I just had no. And she was in utter disbelief. She did not know how I was alive, how I had survived the night. But for me, I actually thought it was a light night. And they were so concerned. Seeing the looks on their faces, I thought, "Oh, wow, maybe this isn't normal behavior." But in the military, it was just so common. There was just no other perspective, no other voice. That level of extremely heavy drinking was what took place, and I didn't know any better. And I continued the behavior for some years thereafter, and it was really only with the support of my family and my friends, people who really cared about me. By that time, I could keep that secret, if you will, for some time functioning well and all of that, going to school. But at some point, the game is up and I could not hide it from anyone in my life anymore and was able to get sober with their support and with treatment. Hazel and Betty Ford was a wonderful place. And I'm honestly extremely fortunate to have a family that had the resources to provide that kind of treatment. And I think all the time about what would happen if we did not have those resources, where I would be today, because I know that's the case for just far too many in Oregon and nationwide. I reflect on this often, knowing that as a kid growing up, I just did not have any of these, any other perspective other than the it's normal to drink, this is just what we do in a society, et cetera, et cetera. I've really made a point of speaking out more often, especially with youth that are engaged with the city. We know that there's many different ways to live, to take care of yourself. And alcohol is something that's out there. I think pretty good. At least growing up, I would never touch any other kind of drug. They really put the fear of God into me about literally anything else. Alcohol as a society is just quite different. I think early sobriety, especially. So for young people, I got sober at a very young age and it was extremely difficult. The peer pressure I faced, lots of questioning at the time, was a person like dating people and things. It was just awful. So many questions. Why aren't you drinking? Why don't you drink? Really every time. So social interactions were very awkward. But as I've gotten a little bit older, that really dissipates quite a bit. So many people I know now are sober and it seems like folks are more aware too and don't ask those same questions. But our society and really our state is intertwined in this crazy dependent relationship with alcohol. And it's very powerful. As a state, Oregon, we make a lot of money off the sale of liquor. And our state spends our tax dollars to promote the sale of alcohol, even as we face an addiction crisis. Alcohol and drug use in general is leading causes of preventable death. And they just cost an immense amount of money annually, and it's destroying lives and families. Somewhat recently, Oregon Health Authority, they launched a great ad campaign, an award-winning ad campaign called the Rethink the Drink. And when I saw this campaign, I thought, wow, this is just incredible. Really good, just to provide a different perspective. And that ad campaign drew a lot of criticism from Oregon's wine industry and then actually received pushback from Oregon folks in the legislature. And that's really representative of what we see here. Whenever we've tried to put efforts forth to create funding for more prevention, for treatment, policies in place to address drinking, there's the knee jerk in Oregon is somewhat for pushback. Alcohol industry has a lot of lobbyists. I'm in the restaurant business. We make money off the sale of liquor. And over the years, of course, we've evolved too. And I'm glad to see a generation of people coming up now who don't always prioritize drinking. We see restaurants nationally and globally that have created a whole non-alcoholic menus. It's just such a big thing now. And I love seeing that, just something that never existed before. The whole zero proof movement is a big deal in a growing industry itself. And so it's good to see them gaining some power, because that will help affect change as well. But again, back in Oregon, just in terms of the pushback, even to adding a person with a background in substance abuse prevention to the OLCC board, which would be a great thing, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. All these things have just been sensitive issues in Oregon. It's, again, great to see you all here tonight, engaging on this important topic, hopefully learning a great deal from the professionals that we have here. And I appreciate you all listening to me as I, share my story. As I said, we keep sobriety, we tend to keep it a secret, and it's really not helping anyone. So when people hear from their community members that they too suffer from addiction, and whether that's yours, parents, their friends' parents, coaches, peers, community leaders, that they have the ability to speak out, I think that's something really powerful and something that more people are doing now. Celebrities, folks in the public eye are doing this more and more, and it just has a big impact. Even on me, the more people I see doing it gives me the courage to do it as well. And then the more people that I knew in recovery, the stronger my commitment to recovery grew. Personally, I think that government should always serve to aid those least fortunate. I think there's always going to be a market, of course, for alcohol, just as there remains a market for cigarettes and other harmful substances, even with all that we know about them. But our public dollars really should be going into prevention, education, treatment, and community engagement.
And that was Lake Oswego Mayor Joe Buck. The Oregon Health Authority says most substance use disorder starts before the age of 25. And a local expert says parents can do a lot to prevent kids from starting down the path to addiction. Dr. Marvin Seppala is an addiction expert, retired chief medical officer for Hazelden Betty Ford. He says children as young as 12 are often getting opportunities to use drugs and alcohol. Dr. Seppala says the biggest risk factor is genetic, having relatives who also have addiction issues. He describes his own struggle at a very young age. Seppala was able to kick his addictions by the age of 19, then went on to become a doctor and expert in addiction medicine.
To discuss alcohol and drug use with your children, with your kids, it's an essential skill to have, because our kids are faced with alcohol and drug questions and issues throughout their life, actually. It's astounding just how young the average age of onset of alcohol use is and cannabis use. And it's actually in the 12 to 13-year-old age range. We have to be attending to this actually from a very young age to be sure that our kids are prepared for that, because their friends are going to ask them about it and they're going to be faced with all kinds of issues that they need to have answers for and skills to address. One important feature of this is that parents always wonder, do I actually have any influence over my children's decisions? And there's been numerous studies examining that very question about alcohol and drug use in particular and the decisions children face. And actually, parents have tremendous influence over these decisions and are crucial to their understanding of this and the decisions that they're going to make. Even though we always think it's just their peers that drive their decision-making, that's not the case at all. Parents have a tremendous role in this, and that's important to know. And intoxicants really do significantly alter brain function, especially for adolescents. Their brains are growing, and they don't mature until their early 20s. Females before males, actually. People born as female sex are going to have matured brains in their real early 20s, like around by 21. But the guys, on the other hand, are going to be in the mid-20s, closer to 25 or so. And I certainly saw that with my son and my daughter, where she was the most organized person in the family, and he had difficulties until his mid-20s, and then just that took off. And all of these substances are really powerful in regard to altering brain function throughout adolescence if people start using. And one major factor is that the earlier onset of use of potentially addictive substances results in a higher risk of addiction, because even if you don't have a genetic risk factor for addiction, which is the primary risk factor, if you start really young, they're powerful enough to alter your brain in a way to put you at risk, whether you had that risk in the first place or not. The reward center is the part of the brain primarily responsible for addiction itself, not necessarily for the feelings of intoxication, although it has a role in that, but it has the major role in addiction. People who don't have addiction to these substances, cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, and alcohol, their brains, as scanned, that reward center is really bright and really lit up well. While the people described as drug users, they don't have that much left anymore. And that reveals a diminishment of a neurotransmitter called dopamine, the primary neurotransmitter involved in addiction, not the only one, but the primary one. And it provides information for that part of the brain about the stimulus, that the drug, and its meaning for the person. The more these drugs are used, the more the brain has to respond to them, because they are so powerful. They're overdriving normal activities in such a way that the brain cells, the genes in those cells, alter what they produce. So the genes can produce proteins, so they'll diminish the number of proteins used for receptor sites for these substances on each of those brain cells, resulting in less attention to what's going on in regard to that drug and all drugs, and actually all rewarding activities. So the more one uses, the more one needs to continue to use to gain the same benefit from the drug. And the less the brain's going to respond to normal stimuli that would usually result in joy and happiness and the sorts of things that we seek in our lives, so that the person actually has to continue to use the drug to get the same benefit. Now, there's multiple risk factors associated with substance use itself. It's just what kind of things put your child at more risk for use and abuse, neglect, maltreatment, the poor parent-child relationships, conflict in the family, parent and family substance misuse itself can drive such thoughts and actions. Favorable parental attitudes about substance use. It's important to know what you're telling your children about this in regard to the risk of their own interest in use and unclear expectations about substance use. We really need to set the expectation. There's social issues like their peer relationships, especially if they're with deviant peers already doing things that are problematic, like gang associations, even popularity seeking, because often people, especially in their teens, think that popularity is associated with doing the things most people do. And although most people don't use these substances, the perception is that most people do. And so it may be a popularity issue to use the substances. And then there's individual risk factors, mental health concerns, abuse of any kind, favorable attitudes towards substance use among themselves and their peers. School performance issues are also part of this. So if you're not doing well in that setting, it's more likely that you're going to seek out substances or other problematic behaviors. In Oregon, where we just recriminalized substances after Measure 110, that laws and norms favorable for substance use actually result in more substance use by our youth. And that's a real problematic aspect of such legislation. By voting in the decriminalization, we actually suggested to our youth less risk associated with these substances, especially since we don't really have prevention programs in the state. Risk factors that actually lead to substance use disorders, and it's on a spectrum from mild to severe. The primary risk factor for addiction itself is genetic. It accounts for about 50% of the risk, which is always surprising to people. I started to drink at age 12, and by 15, I was using multiple substances almost every day, and I dropped out of high school at 17 and was disowned by my family shortly after. Fortunately, they got me into treatment before they disowned me, because I relapsed afterwards. And that was at 17 after leaving high school. And it turned out that I went to the Hazelden Foundation, and I was the first adolescent ever treated. And I didn't remain abstinent right after treatment, but I did get into recovery at age 19 and haven't used any psychoactive substances since. As a result of that, I ended up getting an incredible job in a research lab at the Mayo Clinic, went on to college, went back to Mayo for medical school, and then decided to go into this as a specialty. So I became a psychiatrist and specialized in addiction. But the genetic aspects of this put me at risk from the beginning. Trauma and adverse childhood experiences are second on the list for risk factors related to addiction. And mental health problems are third. Almost any mental health problem actually increases the risk for addiction. Doesn't cause addiction, but increases the risk for addiction, as do some of the behavioral and impulse control issues. People with ADHD, it's untreated, they are at high risk for developing addiction. Early age of onset of the use of these substances is a risk factor for addiction, as well as the use of really highly addictive drugs. When we hear about all the problems in downtown Portland and around the state with methamphetamine and fentanyl, these are extremely potent drugs, and a higher percentage of people will become addicted to them than to other substances. The main issue is having conversations with our children. And refusal skills is a simple thing to start when they're very young, that they can say no to their friends who want to take a toy away from them, or they want to take their chair in the classroom or whatever. They can say no. And then as they age, they can say no to other questions that their friends or other things that friends might ask them to do or that they really don't want to do. And just empower them to be able to make positive decisions, because at some point later, they're going to need that empowerment when they're faced with friends who ask them if they want to drink some alcohol or use some marijuana. And if they're used to saying no to their friends about the simple things, it makes it that much easier to say no to more difficult things like this. I'm an expert in this, and I told my children, and I have this lived history as well, And I probably told my children a little too young about some of that, but I also provided them a degree of understanding from the science when they were quite young. I have two children, and they made decisions together that they weren't going to use until they were out of high school and outside of the home, because it was so important to me as a person in recovery. When you have an example right in front of you, like if in your family you use wine or beer at dinner some evening, it's a good opportunity just to discuss appropriate use of adult beverages. And beer commercials, if you're watching sports, are so common. And it offers an opportunity to discuss appropriate and problematic use of those beverages. My son and his best friend and I were driving to a sporting event. It was in Eugene, going to a Duck game. They were both in junior high at the time. And one of the Blazers had just been caught at the airport with some marijuana. And he was a local guy, grew up in Portland. So he was really highly regarded, and his career was on the downswing. He wasn't playing as well, and he gets caught with marijuana at the airport, a very unusual thing to have happen, and suggestive of not really thinking things through very well. And they asked me about that because I worked in addiction, and they were wondering what was going on. Most of the time, kids look up to athletes. The use of marijuana among athletes reduces the perception of risk among our youth. And when they asked me, it gave me an opportunity to talk about how his career had diminished, how he wasn't playing as well, and how that could be related to marijuana use. Because marijuana actually overstimulates this sense of awe and wonder that we have in our brains. We have these internal cannabis-related chemicals in our bodies that play essential roles in almost all physiologic functioning. When you first use marijuana, you might just find yourself completely taken with the rainbow and the soap bubble in the sink when you're washing dishes or staring at this gorgeous green fur in the backyard. All kinds of things like that get stirred up in unusual ways and significant ways. And doing marijuana once in a while, you can maintain that experience over time, but using marijuana on a daily basis overdrives that system, and the cells downregulate. They are trying to keep normal function in place. These cells just want things to go along pretty evenly day in, day out. And when they're not, they've got to do something about it, and they do. And it removes that ability when people are not using marijuana. So life becomes boring, quite boring, unless they're getting high. And then that sense of awe and wonder comes back. And part of awe and wonder is novel events. And if you're an athlete, especially a basketball player, and you're coming up against a guy that you've guarded, you're playing defense, they're on offense, and you've done this, let's say 50 to 100 times because you play each other multiple times per year. In general, if he puts on a new move, you could respond really well. But if you're smoking pot every day and you don't use the day of the game because it slows your reaction time a little bit, it also results in an inability to recognize that novel event that he puts this new move on and he's suddenly scoring and you're standing there looking at him. And I was able to use that example with those two. And they were really taken with that. And it was a teachable moment. They found it fascinating and saw a good reason not to use marijuana. It's important to make your values and rules really clear about alcohol and drug use. Set expectations from an early age for what you want. In our family, it was no use till you're old enough. You're out of the house and you can make those decisions for yourself. They can get all kinds of information themselves, good and bad, off the internet. So you need to have the real facts and provide that to your kids. And listening is so important because those two are talking about this guy on this drive and it opened the door for that conversation. And that's the type of thing that we need to do on a regular basis with our kids. Guidelines to help them strategize how to avoid alcohol and drug use with role-playing. What would you do if your friend came up to you with a six-pack of beer? You're 13 years old. What are you going to say? How are you going to react to that? Brainstorming about options when faced with a friend that offers some drugs or alcohol. What would you say? What would you do? Establishing a code phrase. This is commonly used for any kind of emergency or urgent sort of situation, to use this code phrase in a text or a phone call when under pressure, like someone's asking you to get high with them. And there was an example of this recently in the city of Lake Oswego, where some girls had an interaction with a father at someone's home that they found to be really uncomfortable. And one of the girls called her mother and did this sort of thing, which is exactly what you want to have done when they're facing really difficult circumstances. And you need to know your children, keeping track of them, where they are, who they're with, how long it's going to last, all those things. My wife has some supernatural power in this regard. When her kids were growing up, and they knew that somehow she would know what they were up to, and it was almost always true. And know your children's friends and their parents as much as possible, so that you have some sense of who they're hanging out with and who those parents are. And you don't want your children to be faced with entering another family's car when the driver's under the influence of alcohol, and not have the ability to say, hey, I'm uncomfortable with this, I got to get out of here, and have a plan for how to do that. We need to be positive role models for our children, and that certainly includes use of psychoactive substances. And we need to keep talking with them and with their friends over time to be sure that we have open communication lines. It's good to start with the most common substances. You don't want to stop there in the long run, but that's the best place to start, because they're always going to be faced with these things first, most likely. And it just opens discussions for the other substances as well. So it's easy to talk about alcohol and how it affects judgment, increasing risky behaviors, and in particular for teens, it impairs driving ability. And only recently, overdose deaths among teenagers has superseded the deaths by car accident for teenagers as the number one accidental cause of death. So these car accidents, extremely problematic for our teens and tragic, and we need to prepare them for that before they get in those situations with friends or even on by themselves. Nicotine, it's good to appeal to things that mean something to them in the moment for our children. So it smells on your clothes, your hair, and your breath. It causes your teeth to go yellow and your fingers get yellow, that sort of thing. Cancer, emphysema, heart disease, the real medical issues associated with it aren't going to get their attention as much, but they still need to know about those things. Kids are risk takers, and they're under pressure. That is a normal part of going through adolescence. So be supportive, stay calm, try to be non-judgmental, describe what you observed, be really specific about what you observed. You walked in, you were stumbling around, I smelled alcohol on your breath, your speech was a little slurred, that sort of thing, to really fully describe what you witnessed. And then repeat those family values, rules, and expectations. And state the facts about the use of these substances and the risks that they're taking. Set the limits again, provide guidance, and then seek an expert for help if this continues. If you have a strong family history for addiction, it may be a time to go in and talk to an expert. And don't assume that your physician or even a psychologist, a general psychologist, knows much about addiction. You need to go to someone with expertise in addiction, because it's not well taught in medical school or in PhD programs. So the signs of substance use are really hard to address in a quick manner. It could be substance use. And they're changing friends without obvious reasons, dropping in grades, unexpected school absences. They're no longer motivated about most anything, secretive and moody, isolating, changes in appetite and sleep patterns. If suddenly they're using air fresheners in the car, in their room, and breath mints and perfumes to cover up smells, could be alcohol or smoking marijuana, bloodshot eyes, pupillary changes, slurred speech, give you a sense of more of a higher likelihood of a substance use problem than just standard adolescence or depression or some other mood disorder. Start early. Really important to start early.
That's Dr. Marvin Seppala, the retired chief medical officer from Hazelden Betty Ford.
You're listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks for tuning in here on your favorite Alpha Media radio station. If you have a topic you would like to hear about on this show, please send me an email about it to annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. One more time, that's annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Join us again next week and check out our Speaking Freely podcast on KXL.com.